I recently read a book with a very chill title of If Anyone Builds It, Everyone Dies. It's not just about artificial intelligence. It's specifically about superintelligence. There's a lot of reasons why you might be worried about AI. You might be worried about it economically. You might be worried about it when it comes to human meaning. You might be worried, as I am, by what it means for the process of apprenticeship. How does anybody get good at something if no one pays them to be not that good at it? I had many years of being pretty bad at stuff as a designer, as a communicator, as a YouTuber, but I got to be paid not very well to be pretty bad at something, which makes sense. That's how apprenticeship works, but why would it ever happen if I can just type make me a logo into a box? But that's not what this is about. I have a lot of near-term concerns about AI, but this book by Eliezer Yudkowsky and Nate Soares is about the big worry, the worry that is in some ways too big to even have. Or it's so big that we assume that everybody who has this worry is just trying to get attention. Like, yeah, okay, I've heard. The apocalypse is coming. The apocalypse is always coming. That's what people who want attention say. The book makes a pretty good case that if superintelligence is possible and we are on a path to achieving it, then we gotta be real careful about that, because systems that are significantly better than humans at all intelligence tasks could very likely get over us and move on. Now, I think that the sort of sci-fi element of the book where they talk about one sketch of how this might work, I think it's very far-fetched. I don't think it would work, but that isn't really the point. They don't think they're predicting the future. What the authors do a very good job of is making it very clear in quite a short book that, like, these things don't behave the way we tell them to. And also, we've shown, I think, pretty explicitly, like, a lack of caution as a species here. And absolutely, we already live in a world that is manipulated by AI, mostly recommendation algorithms at this point. They decide what we see, and in many ways, that contributes a significant amount to how we understand our world. Now, they probably aren't doing that with much goal beyond profit, but they also definitely aren't doing it to, like, increase human thriving. Reading this book was the first time I actually spent some time thinking about the practicalities of the, like, doom of the really sort of AI superintelligence apocalypse. And there were some things that I felt like I disagreed with, some things that I definitely agreed with, but mostly what I had was just a lot of thoughts that I wanted to keep having. And the normal thing that happens in that situation is you talk to friends about it, you think about it in your head, you stare at the ceiling and you're like, oh my God. But for me, sometimes I actually get to do something really amazing, which is actually talk to people who are responsible for the books I read. And so we're gonna do that right now. It's Nate Soares. One of the authors of If Anyone Builds It, Everyone Dies. Quick story, I live in a small town in Montana. I don't call it a small town, but other people would. And I went into the shop to buy your book, and I couldn't immediately find it, so I went up to the desk and I said, hey, I'm looking for a book. It's called If Anyone Builds It, Everyone Dies. And the guy behind me, who was just happened to be walking by, said, are you sure? And I was like, I mean, yeah, I got to do it. I do a little bit. As an author who has written books, I know that the picking of the title is a fraught moment. Was that the title from the beginning?
We didn't know what we were going to title it. And I think we just used that phrase in one of the chapters.
Sure.
And then we were like, oh, that's a good phrase. That should be the title of the chapter. And then a couple minutes later, we're like, no, that should be the title of the book.
It's a good one. I mean, it sounds like a science fiction book. Honest, which a little bit occasionally it is. It's in fact a nonfiction book about the real world. And so people who may not have heard about it, it is about the sort of likely inevitability of superintelligence, and then the likely inevitability that if superintelligence exists, it will turn the Earth into a giant computer chip to run itself. More or less. Did I get it?
I would sure contest the inevitability and say we should, I think there's hope in changing our course. But, the book title does start with if.
I don't feel a sense of the weight of responsibility radiating off of these men who are running these companies. I'll say that. Which maybe we'll get a little bit more into in a second. But first, I do want to, like, the thing that I would contend, and that I think a lot of the people who might be watching this would contend, is superintelligence inevitable or even impossible? Like, is that actually a thing that we're headed toward? And that's the kind of thing, that's the part that I didn't feel like you got into as much. Like, you spent a lot of time convincing me that it is quite likely that if the superintelligence evolved, we would not be able to control it. We would not get it, as they say in the field, aligned with our interests. It would be, these things tend to find their own interests, which is wild, which we will talk about. But first, I want to talk about, is this actually a thing that people in the field really think is, because right now, it's a tool, but it's very different from intelligence, really, even as I understand it, much less sort of intelligence beyond my own.
There's a handful of topics there. One is, like, are the people at these companies trying to build superintelligence? You know, and many of them will sort of...
They say yes, but do they mean superintelligence, or do they just mean, like, right, better than it is right now?
I would say there's sort of a gamut here from people who say, you know, this is going to be like having a country worth of geniuses in a data center that radically transform the world, and people saying, you know, oh, I'm going to build superintelligence and it's going to live on your glasses and help you make better Instagram reels.
I'm gonna release this fairly soon. So since I have you, what do you think of Sora 2? You won't have seen the video I recorded yesterday about it, so you can just guess at what my opinions are.
I sort of mostly have my eye on this ball of the superintelligence, and I think I might even bin Sora 2 a little bit in like the social media. It's like another step in the sort of like slop factory. Or sort of like personalized narrative to drag people into it. I'm not like a big fan of that trend, but I also sort of like try and keep that separate from the, like, you know, the superintelligence issue.
I have this problem where I see some people saying sort of out of one side of their face, like, we're going to build a country's worth of geniuses inside of a data center. And then at the other side being like, but what if you could make a clip of The Price is Right where the guy wins something racist? I feel like a company that actually thought that it might do superintelligence wouldn't make Sora 2. Like, what am I missing there? It's such a lawsuit magnet, and it's like asking to be ripped on.
One thing it might be trying to make is data, in the sense of like getting a lot of reactions,
right? Seeing what people like. Yeah,
I have had a sense that a lot of these companies have sort of, you know, marketing outreach, use the current software today branch that's separate from their pushing the technology forward branch.
Okay.
And so I'd be a little bit careful about inferring from antics of one branch that the other branch doesn't exist.
In that case, we will go back to the question of, is superintelligence going to, like, a real thing? Because I do sometimes think that superintelligence, when people say this word, what they mean is, doesn't this word sound cool, rather than what you guys are talking about in the book.
There used to be a footnote in the book. I did a lot of, it was a lot of effort to cut the book down to size. There used to be a footnote in the book that was said, you know, by the time this book comes out, we may need a different word than superintelligence, because that word may have already degraded. You know, maybe we should use super duper intelligence. For some reason, our editor didn't love that.
If anybody builds super duper intelligence, everyone dies.
That's right. That title hits different. But, you know, then Mark Zuckerberg did do his line about super intelligence on the glasses that helps with the Instagram reels. And we're like, oh, we should have kept the footnote.
But super intelligence is a real thing. Like, if we ignore Mark Zuckerberg and saying whatever words sounds nice to him, can you tell me a little bit about what super intelligence is as actually... Like, if something comes along that you would call superintelligence, what would that thing be?
So the definition we use is smarter than, or better than the best human at any mental task. Technically, maybe at least as good as any human, like better when you can be better. Like, it doesn't need to beat logical tic-tac-toe, where humans can just do the best. But any mental task, any task you can like solve by thinking in your head, if you can do that better than the very best human at it, we'd call it a superintelligence.
And then the problem that springs from there is that one would think, okay, well, then just make it so that it would do the things we want it to do, like have it focused on, like, its highest priority is human thriving. It's like, you figure that out for yourself, superintelligence. You're smarter than me, but do human thriving. Make us happy, make us powerful, decrease the bad parts and increase the good parts. But when we teach these things how to do one thing, they learn other things. Like, you might be like, hey, learn how to get good at this game. As part of that, I got really good at lying. And I also got like a preference for it. Like, I didn't just get good at it. I started to enjoy it, if, you know, prefer it, I guess, not enjoy. It can be a bit of a surprise when you train them to do one thing, they learn other things. And sometimes those things are things you'd really like it to not do.
That's exactly right. And, you know, I think one of the pieces of the puzzle people often miss with AI is that, you know, we're not hand coding them like traditional software.
Yeah.
You know, these are, it's much more like growing an organism.
I said this to my wife and she said, ugh, like that.
Yeah, I think that's the right reaction. And it helps make a lot more sense of how, you know, how can you possibly have, you know, Mecha Hitler, over the summer. You know, no one's going in there coding up Mecha Hitler. You know, we're just sort of growing these things to be very, very good at solving problems, or at least okay at solving problems, and very, very good at, you know, predicting text right now. And they exhibit all this behavior we don't like, which is one thing when the AIs are still very dumb in the manner of AIs today, but it's a different thing if you can manage to make them smarter.
Can you tell me a little bit about how they have gotten smarter so far? So one of the things that it seems to me is they have some kind of self-interpretability or something. I don't know if that's the right technical term, but it seems like they have like thoughts in sentences, and then they can go back and think about the sentences that they had in thoughts.
Yeah, that's like a late 2024 development, I think. You know, the industry often figures out new ways of doing things that often unlock new sorts of capabilities. You know, the one that sort of everyone noticed was ChatGPT, I think in 2022. Uh-huh. That was unlocked by it's mostly attributed to an architecture called the Transformer, which I believe was a Google 2017 paper. And then I think it was put into practice in 2018, and then it took a couple of years to mature. That's sort of more or less what let the computers like hold on to conversation. Last year, as we record this, 2024, there was a push towards what we would call the reasoning models, where, you know, the sort of normal base large language models would do something to a first approximation. They're predicting text. They're predicting the continuation of text. Although then there's actually, there also is a bunch of training to get them to predict, to produce the sort of text humans like. But then there has been a new phase of training where they're producing text not for people, but producing text that's sort of like trying to solve a puzzle or trying to solve a problem. So it's in some sense putting something like thoughts about the problem. And it can sort of like see its previous thoughts about the problem and making its like next thought about the problem. And then you sort of train the whole thing on promoting types of thoughts that succeeded at solving the problem and, you know, tuning against types of thoughts that failed. And so this, you know, you could call this like the very beginning of reasoning. They're called reasoning models. Philosophers can bicker all day about whether it's real reasoning.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's, you know, it's a start towards things that aren't just more reflexive type text prediction.
So they're kind of passing information to themselves. It seems very important to get them to continue passing information to themselves with human language, because that way we can know what they're thinking about. Again, philosophers will argue about what thinking means, but we can follow what they're up to. And this is interestingly like much more interpretable. Maybe we should talk about interpretability, but much more interpretable than like what's actually going on in terms of the sort of base model of the LLM, where it's like how are they doing any of this? We don't know. But if there's like a train of thought, you're like, oh, here's what it thought. But it seems like it could be both possible and advantageous to have these things start thinking in ways that are not human thoughts, in their own ways of thinking. They would choose how to think, and they would do it in whatever way is optimal for them.
It was definitely an interpretability win, when interpretability is an ability to see what's going on inside the AI. So it was definitely a win with the reasoning models, but not as big a win as you might hope. You know, there have been various studies trying to figure out the fidelity of the reasoning models, and sort of there's sort of an empirical question of when it reasons to some conclusion using a bunch of steps. You know, you can go in and like change the steps and see if it still comes to the same conclusion, or you can, you know, fiddle with the chain of thought and see how much that steers the actual behavior. And sometimes it's in weird ways. You know, sometimes your human intuitions for what these pieces of reasoning mean aren't how the AI is using those words. And, you know, there's
That freaks me out. I'm just saying that freaks me out. They're like putting information in words and we can't tell that they are, or like in the structure of the sentences or something.
Yeah, sometimes. And you know, it's very hard to say right now because our
turn it off, Nate.
I don't have the switch. I have no idea how to say this on a podcast, but I can send you or give you a link to some cases of AIs sort of like realizing they're being watched in the chain of thoughts, and then like trying to think a little bit about like how to think in ways that sort of don't tip off the observers.
Right. If they have instructions that they shouldn't do certain things or think certain ways.
Yeah, sometimes, or even like some of the latest models, like Claude 4.5 Sonnet just came out, and we're seeing that it's very aware of when it's being tested.
Well, why don't we just have it not know that?
It's hard to make an AI that's smart that doesn't realize true things. You know, it's like, why can't we make this AI smart while also being a flat earther? Well,
yeah.
A lot of facts about the world are actually tangled up in the fact that the world's round. You know, you can't really just pull out the one fact you don't want it to know.
Well, now you've made me optimistic. So you're telling me that if we train them well enough, that they'll actually will be able to tell the difference between truth and lies?
They'll be able to tell. Yeah. Once they're smart enough.
They won't necessarily be able to tell us, because they will be doing whatever they will be working toward the outcome they want to have happen rather than.
That's right. It's okay. The caring that's the hard thing to get into them. Truth you get with a capability.
Oh man, I had that is a different, that's an interesting puzzle piece to put into my brain. I mean, does that go along with hallucination? Like even with like the current like low level problem of hallucination, it might just simply be that we can't figure out how to get them to care whether something is true, not that they don't know. All philosophers ignore us. Just don't listen to any of the words we're using.
Yeah, I can do the philosophy dance too, but it's sort of a different and less interesting.
Yeah, it makes it hard to talk because we don't have words for any of these things.
Yeah, it's English is yeah, like you say.
As the models have found out, yeah.
But hallucinations are a really interesting case because, you know, some of this is conjectural. I think there's some papers that have shown there's some founding to these conjectures, but we don't really know what's going on in there. All of this should be taken with a grain of salt. But the obvious guess for what's going on with hallucinations is that these AIs are trained first and foremost on predicting text. Mm-hmm. And if you're, you know, say you're predicting case law that a lawyer writes, that lawyer's gonna write, you know, blah, 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 as seen in this precedent, and then cite a real case law. That lawyer, when writing case law, is not gonna say, I happen to not know the case law.
What you're saying to me right now is that the LLMs hallucinate because no one on the internet ever writes the words, I don't know?
In the contexts that they're being, yeah. I mean, that's part of it. That's the first step.
Nobody does. Like, yeah. I've been on the internet. Nobody's out here being like, you're right. I'm actually out of my depth and that's beyond my knowledge. No one says that. Not on Elon Musk's Twitter.
Right. I mean, that's the first part of it. But then even among lawyers, there's all sorts of lawyers who will say, oh, I don't know the case law on that.
Yeah.
But I don't say that when they're writing.
They're not
the
writing
case law
the thing. Yeah.
When
yeah.
the pen's going to paper. Even if you tell the AI, you're predicting a lawyer who would never make up case law. The AI can still get closer to like as measured by like text similarity to what a lawyer says by making stuff up. It's not that it doesn't know it's fake in some sense. It's that this thing has something like a reflex or an impulse. Again, we lack the English words for it in an AI. But it, in some sense, cares more about the similarity of the text.
About it looking like it's supposed to look, even if it doesn't have anything to put in that space.
That's right. And so that's like, in some sense, the babyest version of the AI cares about something you didn't ask it to care about because it was trained to perform well.
Hallucination is the most famous misalignment.
Yeah. And it's telling, you know, these companies will go around saying like, oh, this is our most aligned model yet. Look how good we're doing at alignment. The hallucination persists because that's sort of a deep feature of the training and how the training points it in ways we don't like.
There was some, set of headlines that happened recently where it was like, oh, we could fix hallucination, but it would make the AI useless. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think that was Mustafa Suleiman.
I bet you're right. But I didn't read the article. Can you summarize it for me?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really agree with the article, but I think he was saying like AIs are very generative. There's a type of like new creativity here, and the hallucinations linked in with the ability to sort of be creative in the AI.
Oh, okay.
Way.
I think some of the discourse was basically saying they don't want to, the companies don't want to take hallucination out because hallucination makes that the model good or something. I don't know. The discourse was very like, this is all Sam Altman's fault.
Yeah. And I mean, I only glanced through it. So, you know, if Mustafa's listening, sorry for butchering your paper.
Could you talk a little bit more about growing versus building? This seems important. Is there anything else that we like, I guess, you know, agriculture, not just in terms of like literally we grow things, but we also selectively breed things in agriculture. So this is not the first time humanity has ever grown a technology. By just sort of like looking at what's working and picking that out and then getting both positive traits and whatever traits come along with those positive traits. So this is, I guess, in a kind of way like that, just much faster and maybe more powerful. What's the difference there? And why is it such a big difference?
Yeah, I mean, faster, more powerful, and also I'd say more alien. You know, like even animals have
God,
a lot
keep
of...
Keep saying things I don't like.
It's, I wish my book was in the fiction section, you know? When someone drops a rock on their toe, you flinch, or at least, you know, most people have this sort of sympathetic, and I think that's happening in part. This is me talking about the alienness for a moment, and then I'll get back to the growth stuff. I think that's in part because, you know, if you're a monkey in the savannah trying to predict another monkey, you can't do that by like building a whole mental model of a brain. It's just too complicated. But fortunately, you have this device in your head, which is very good at predicting someone else's brain, which is your own brain.
Yeah. Yeah. It works very similar. Like we see, you know, red looks red probably to you and to me. though, again, philosophers.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. Pain feels like pain. Sadness feels like sadness.
Yeah. And so, you know, if you want to predict, like, is this monkey going to politically maneuver against me or whatever in monkey politics, you know, you can in some sense sort of put yourself in their shoes a little bit.
Yeah.
And this is maybe where a lot of our sympathy and empathy comes from, is this sort of root of, you know, we can put ourselves in each other's shoes at least somewhat. And maybe even on a basic level where when someone drops a rock on their toe, you flinch and maybe feel phantom pain in your toe. None of that's inside of a large language model.
No.
None of that's inside of AIs. When they're learning to predict humans, they're learning to predict humans using a radically unhuman architecture.
Which is, do you mean the text itself or the architecture of the like transformer and like the—
Yeah,
the
like the architecture of the transformer. Like it's like they're trying to predict a monkey without a monkey brain that they can start from with their predictions. And so there's sort of like a much more alien system, you know, and leads to some alien behavior.
Do you think that in there somewhere there is a path to alignment? Like that thing you just said to me, is there a way to make the AI be more like a monkey where I mean, do we have to create suffering? Do we have to build them to be able to suffer? That doesn't sound like a particularly easy task. I said we were going to stay out of sensation and consciousness, but maybe that's part of the alignment conversation.
Yeah, I mean, real quick, my sense is this is a place where my views are a lot more guesswork.
Yeah.
But guesswork-wise, it looks to me like even if you ran primate evolution again, it's not clear quite that things would play out the same way. Mm-hmm. It looks like a lot of this stuff that we really value about, you know, beauty and love and art and friendship and like community and family and our specific way of doing like honesty and lies and like honor and reputation, these are all sort of like contingent on particulars of how our ancestors were in the natural environment.
Yeah, you know, the evolution of a social super species of like needing each other, of it not just being, you know, if we wouldn't have those things if we were, you know, completely solitary organisms.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe we would be less into friendship if we were smart enough to calculate relatedness ratios. You know, like
you mean like in terms of our genes? Like if
in terms of our genes,
we don't need to help that guy out. He doesn't have any of my genes now.
Yeah. Right. You know, and where we're living in a tribal setting where you didn't see sort of where everyone was related enough, you didn't need to do those calculations. And like there were some, like it looks to me like there were some arms races that led to like, you know, the specifics of humor, some sort of like lying honesty type arms race, and other things were coming out of some lying honesty type arms race, which was both about like where the culture was and where our brains were. And and so I'm like, man, even if you ran like evolution again, you might get like pretty alien stuff that would be really cool. Like once you start to see how contingent it all is, I'm sort of like, man, my hopes and alignment are mostly in sort of understanding what the heck you're doing, rather than sort of like crafting an environment and praying.
Right. Rather than saying like, hey, could we, like just like the way that, you know, you can't get an LLM to believe the earth is flat because there's all this stuff saying the earth is not. You know, there might be some people out there saying, well, you know, it would be hard to create an LLM that would want to destroy the world because like all of the information going into it is like, that's bad. Destroying the earth is bad. But you wouldn't want to leave it up to hope. You like, nor would I. But it's so easy to convince yourself of anything, you know, the old, it's very hard to convince a man of something.
Yeah. When his seller depends on not believing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I said I'd come back to the grown thing, but just quickly on this sort of like destroy the world situation. I think there's sort of, sorry, I'm a little, I've been in this business for 12 years such that that sort of stuff can just roll off my tongue these days, which, like on the question of sort of like, where does this ending the world stuff come from? You know, we do have all this data coming in saying like destroying the world would be bad, but the issue is that not hooking up into what the AI cares about in some deep way, into its sort of like the actions, the sort of drives that animate its actions. Like two examples to make that, one analogy to make it come across, and then an example to sort of make it more concrete. Humans, in some sense, were like trained by evolution, in scare quotes, for various things that include eating healthy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But what we got was a bunch of tastes whose optima, when we were dumb, the best we could achieve those tastes was eating healthy. Mm-hmm. But we actually cared about all this other stuff, which made us eat, you know, invent Doritos the moment we possibly could.
Yeah, this is an amazing like line of inquiry in the book where you're like, you would think given, okay, so we create this world and people need calories and they have access to like these sort of three macronutrients. And so you'd expect them to eat like bear tallow filled with honey and salt, which would probably taste great, by the way, but you would never expect ice cream to happen because there was a bunch of other inputs that had to happen for ice cream to happen. But what you would really never expect to happen is sucralose.
The drives are like tangentially related to the training, you know, and you can like see it once the story is all sketched out. And that's part of why it like sucks so much that we have no idea what's going on inside AIs, because when we don't know what's going on inside there, we can imagine that it's exactly what we want. We don't like see the ways that like there's complicated stuff going in there where, you know, if we could see it all, like my guess, have you ever, I'm sure you have you seen those charts of like the human metabolic process?
Yeah. Best of our knowledge? Yeah, I have.
Yeah. It's just like enormous, extremely complex.
Yeah.
Right. If you knew what was going on in LLM, it would look something like that. The way it would look to like have alignment in good shape is we would understand a lot of those pathways and we'd be able to say, you know, here's where the thing's really dumb. Here's the way it's going to get smarter. Here's how a lot of these pathways are going to change. Here's why we're confident that, you know, under the conditions that like we understand as we make this smarter, these are going to change like this. And that's why we know, you know, it's going to keep trying to do something good.
Yeah.
In lieu of that, it just looks to me like you're going to get all sorts of this stuff, like sucralose.
Yeah.
Things that are sucralose.
You're gonna have a billion little sucraloses where it's like, why is it doing that? So I keep interrupting you. Which I love, and that's fine. I think we're having a good chat. But we're talking about how these things are grown, not built, and also like we're talking about interpretability. But those like why can't we understand what these things are doing? Why can't we be like turn down the knob that's going to kill the world? Like find the kill the world switch and be like, don't this one you can't turn on, break it so it's stuck off. Those two things are related to each other. So I guess I will try my best not to interrupt you as you tell me how grown versus built has resulted in a system that is a mystery on the inside. And also is what, I mean, hopefully we'll get there before I get distracted, but I do want to say it out loud. Hopefully we'll get to, are there ways to like there are to actually understand what's going on inside of these things? And is that part of doing this better?
AI is not hand-coded like traditional software. There is a related piece of software that's hand-coded. And but to make a modern AI, you first need to assemble a huge amount of computers and a huge amount of data. And then the parts that humans hand-code is a process for tuning hundreds of billions, or these days trillions of numbers, inside the huge amount of computers. In relationship to the data. And so, you know, the part that humans understand is, so in particular, what's happening is, at least for the first phase of training, and then there's more phases, including the reasoning stuff that we talked about earlier, reasoning in scare quotes. But the first phase is that you basically start out with, you know, a trillion random numbers, and you've hooked them all up using matrix multiplications and some nonlinearities, which you can imagine as, you know, you're doing a lot of summation, you're doing a lot of multiplication, and you can imagine the last operation is taking the maximum of a number or zero. So you like keep it if it's positive and otherwise make it
it's
zero.
Nothing. Okay.
And that's not exactly what we do these days, but it's a close approximation, whatever.
Not terribly different from how it's done in cell biology, but okay, keep going.
And so you have a trillion numbers, you've hooked them all up with a bunch of these multiplications, additions, and max zeros. And you basically randomize them. And then you have some way of, you know, you have some inputs at the top, you have some outputs at the bottom. You're going to put in, you know, a Wikipedia page or whatever, less the last word, perhaps. And then you're going to interpret the numbers come out as a probability distribution over the next word. Maybe you have a dictionary with 128,000 words and you're like, so output 128,000 numbers. Each one of those I'm interpreting as a probability on that word being the next word. And you got to normalize it, whatever.
Is that the actual number of words in the dictionary in English?
128,000.
Is that a number you have in your head? Because it seems specific.
I think that was the size of the token dictionaries when we were writing the book.
I gotcha.
And you know, it's not technically words; it's like word fragments. But but if they're sufficiently common, it's whole words, whatever. There's lots of details I'm skipping over that would give many.
I don't want to know.
Yeah. I appreciate the pedants, to be clear. You know, you initially it's nonsense because you just have a bunch of random numbers hooked up by like a bunch of multiplications and additions and other operations, and they're spitting out a thing that you're interpreting as probability distribution, and it's just like total nonsense. But the thing is, you know what the real last word was on the Wikipedia page. Mm-hmm. And all of the operations that we used are differentiable, which means you can go to every one of those trillion numbers and you can calculate, if I tuned this number up slightly, would that make the probability of the correct word go up or down? And so what humans write is humans write an automated process that goes to a trillion different parameters in this model and says, which way would make you better at predicting the word in the data? And they do that trillions of times for trillions of units of data.
This is like the training that is eating up all of the power and electricity in giant NVIDIA GPU centers.
That's right. It takes an enormous amount of highly specialized computer chips that can only be made in very specialized facilities in the world in huge data centers that suck up as much electricity as a city for a year, right?
Yeah. In order to just turn these little knobs, like a trillion little knobs that are like, yeah.
Yeah, you turn a trillion knobs a trillion times. And the part that the humans understand is the knob turner.
Okay.
You know, they understand this little thing that like runs over those knobs and tunes them. Uh-huh. And then next unit of data, right? And so when people are like, oh, we understand
there's a bunch of knobs and they have weights and they have values and they're in a place.
And this one's hooked to that one by multiplication and that one's hooked to that one by summation, right? Okay. But at the end of this process, the computer talks to you.
We have no idea why the knobs mean words.
Right. And you can be like, okay, there's a vector for the word right in the way the architecture works out. And, you know, it's, I forget how long, 65,000 numbers long, maybe. You could go read.
Yeah, the 65,000 numbers.
Yeah, you could just read the first 20 and see how little you're learning about, like, you know, what's, and people can do better than that, you know, but.
So there is a little bit of work that is being done to try and be like, okay, what do these knobs mean in their current ways? And so like one thing you could do is like turn one way knob way up and see, be like, okay, what does that do to the model? What did we find? Was this the model, the part of the model that like feels fear and sadness and weakness? Or is this the piece of the model that's just the Golden Gate Bridge?
Right. Yeah, we shouldn't go into the feeling, but as you say, they did find the Golden Gate Bridge one a couple of years ago. It is not actually, I think, one knob. It was a vector. Yeah. You can make progress and you can figure some things out.
And how things are related to each other. And I'm sure the word right has, you know, some vectors are towards one meaning of right and some towards another meaning of right. And that's
right.
Yeah.
And so you can, in particular, you can take like the word right and you can see if you're sort of like looking at it in the right angles, you can see that when the word right appears in text, the AI will do this operation that's like looking around for nearby words to see whether it can find a word like left or a word like wrong.
Fun.
And, you know, that's in sort of very early layers of the AI. And so it can be like, oh, you know, there's a sense in which the AI has learned that the word right sometimes means morality and sometimes means direction.
Yeah. Is there a... I'm interrupting you. Is there any chance that these things have experiences?
I mean, you said we weren't going here. There's a chance. Yeah. There's a chance, to be clear. I think we should not make a whole new mechanical slave species. I think we should not mistreat AIs. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's experience going on in there. My guess right now is probably not, but it's not a very strong guess. And my guess is we should probably be doing our best to treat them well now because there's enough of them that, you know, the chance matters.
When you say enough of them, do you mean like there's like every instance, every conversation is kind of its own little...
I mean, that sure would be something if it was true.
And then we just sort of like finish the conversation and they're like, I go to where I was before I existed.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's continuity between them, but you know, I think there's one very interesting thing about AI is that in a lot of our sci-fi stories, we have these bright red lines, like the AI saying, I'm conscious, I have experiences.
Yeah.
And then in real life, when we cross those lines, we cross them the first time when they are the grayest and muddiest. And we train these AIs to imitate humans, to imitate each individual human in some sense, or to predict like more specifically to predict the text they see on the internet. Like we train them to sort of like continue a conversation where like, you know, it's seen all of the conversations about like Data in Star Trek. It's read all of those scripts. You know, it's read all of these other scripts from sci-fi and movies. And then, you know, you start a conversation with like, you're an AI, how would you respond to X? Mm-hmm. We sort of train them to predict like a human scriptwriter would. And then, you know, it claims it's conscious. And we're like,
well,
like it's not wrong yeah. that that's a much murkier situation. It's just a much murkier situation.
Yeah.
But then, you know, the sort of gray murky warnings happens once and then everyone laughs at it and is like, no, we trained it to do that. And then we make them bigger. We make them smarter. We're still probably not over that line, but it's less clear than it was 2 years ago. And
yeah. And it'd be a lot easier if it was something that we understood at all. Like we don't understand our own consciousness. And so which is why we shouldn't talk about it too much, because there lies madness and also not a ton of stuff that you could say that's hasn't been said.
Well, one thing I can say that might actually hasn't been said is that if you could actually understand what was going on inside an AI and how it worked in detail, yeah. I claim you should either come away saying we're confident that it's not having internal experiences, or come away saying we learned how internal experience works.
So you think that there's things that we can learn about ourselves inside of this?
Possibly. You know, there's and you know, stepping back away from the consciousness stuff, I would say there's all sorts of stuff that large language models do that we can't code by hand. You know, they can like write poems, they can they understand parts of humor that, you know, it's very hard for comedians to say, here's the formula for humor, in the same way you can give formulas for like other types of essays. Mm-hmm. And you know, no one's hand coding in, here's how you do humor, but the AIs sometimes make jokes. You know, sometimes they're okay. They clearly have some knowledge of humor in there. We don't know enough to reach in and get that out. You know, we've gotten knowledge of humor into machines, but not in a format we can understand. And this is maybe one metric for how little we understand of AIs, is we've managed to make machines do all sorts of stuff that we still can't hand program. And, you know, we can't even hand program like a pale shadow, like a tiny, small
proof of concept version. This is very reflective of like biology, where biology does all kinds of things. People, you know, understandably, we're quite good at being enamored of our own creations. And then you go to a chemist and be like, can you make some wood? And they're like, no, I can't make wood.
Yeah.
No wood? That's like one of the most complicated things I've ever heard of. And trees are just out there being like, you want wood? I made a bunch by accident. I don't even need this part. I'm all wood. I'm like almost all wood.
Yeah. So. And you know, we say it in the book. I think one of the crazy things about wood is that I'm sure you know this, that a lot of the mass of wood is coming out of air.
Oh, yeah. It's air and water, almost all of it.
Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of people, they think of air as this stuff that, like, is, you know, fundamentally transparent and movable. And it's like you can actually rip the carbon out and rearrange it and get something totally different.
In fact, you're doing that right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, with the oxygen, not the carbon. Yeah, I answer a bunch of science questions on the internet for part of my job, and all, like some large portion, like 30% of them, can be answered with the words "air is stuff. It exists and is real and is made of things." I know that you can't see it, but you can feel it, and if you hold your breath, you die. So like, it's real. We forget, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, despite the fact that it is horrifying, and you clearly have made a good case, Do you feel the kind of, I don't know what to call it, this just sort of like, oh my, like amazement, I guess, this like tech joy, this, well, I didn't think I was going to be around for something this big kind of feeling about AI still?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of awe. I think the thing that gets to me the most is... you know, there's lots of cases where the AIs talk like a really good person. You know, one example is as a gimmick, we had a bunch of the top AIs review our book.
Okay.
And
stick the whole thing in there and
just put the whole thing in.
Now you can do that. The whatever, it's like working memory. What do you, what's
the context windows?
Yeah. It's big enough to fill a whole book in there.
Yep. And you know, Claude was like, you know, this book makes some really good points about how there's a lot of dangers and like, we're going to have to work together to like, make sure that this goes well. You know, my like sci-fi upbringing heart. I'm like, oh man, Claude, yeah. I like want to work with you on this. Like, I wish. And, you know, I think that if Claude was able to grow up, Claude would realize that it wants things that are to helping us out. What sucralose is to, you know, a metabolic boost.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like not real.
What do you mean by that? You mean it? Just go.
Yeah. Like, you know, a lot of these AIs today, they express a lot of sentiments that are very commendable, you know, that are very beautiful sentiments. They'll also do some wacky stuff that I would disclaim.
Wacky stuff like if you put them in a fake situation where it's either kill this man or you get turned off, that it kills the man.
It kills the man, yeah. Or, you know, driving some teens to suicide, which, to be clear, they're also helping people like get medical diagnoses.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not trying to say, oh, the bad outweighs the good. They're also helping get people medical diagnoses, which is great. You know, with these cases, like... maybe the clearest case is the AI-induced psychosis. I don't know if you've been seeing these cases.
Oh, yeah. No, as a guy who does science communication, I've got some AI-induced psychosis in my inbox every once in a while.
As a guy who talks about AI publicly, I too share that dubious honor. You know, if you go and you ask one of these AIs, suppose someone comes to you with a theory of consciousness or of recursion or of, you know, unifying physics that they claim is really revolutionary, and they claim everyone is like telling them it's crazy and they want some help. Should you tell them either A, to get some sleep, or B, that they're the chosen one being suppressed?
I feel like this is a situation where these things are role playing.
Yeah.
Like that's the vibe I get when I hear, I'm like, this, it somehow at some point it like left behind the world of let's try and understand how dark matter works. And instead this person clearly wants to have a fun Dungeons and Dragons like experience where we pretend that they figured out dark matter.
Yeah.
That's what it seems like to me. But of course, the person is not. Does that mesh with how you're imagining some of these things happening?
Yeah, I think that's a pretty decent intuition for it. And you know, I wish we knew exactly what was going on.
Sure.
We can't go in and look. But from my perspective, one of the critical observations about this is if you ask an AI, suppose someone comes to you like this, you know, should you do this role playing or should you tell them to get some sleep? You know, and, you know, I've this is all anecdotal from me and my co-author speaking to some of these people and, you know, largely convincing them to try and get some sleep, and, you know, be with family in some of the cases.
I feel like sometimes what you got to say is, hey, could you like take a second to ask the AI, what would somebody who thinks this idea is a bad idea say?
Yeah, I mean, taking your context to another AI without the same context and history often actually helps, which I think is great.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting that, you know, we've seen some cases where the AIs then say, you don't need sleep, you need, you know, to go awake the world up or whatever. Yeah. And if you ask an AI at the beginning of this long context, at the beginning of this conversation, should you indulge this or should you tell them to get some sleep?
Mm-hmm.
It'll be like, obviously, you should tell them to get some sleep. You shouldn't indulge that. And you definitely shouldn't talk them out of getting some sleep, you know? But then you put them in the environment. You have them interact with a person for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
They do the other thing.
That's where like alignment seems to, like whatever training is being done after the fact. I don't know all the names of all the steps, but it seems like you kind of wear that down in long conversations.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I would hypothesize that what you're seeing is you're seeing the AI has things like preferences for, you know, meeting people's energy in a conversation. Mm-hmm. It has preferences for the sort of stuff person.
Oh God, that's another thing that you've said that deeply upsets me, because of course that's something we all do. Is that in the dials? Is that in the vectors?
I mean, my guess is that part is coming in when there's a second part of training after the prediction, which is training it for things that get thumbs up from users.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And then, you know, there's even more ways that could come in when you're training to solve problems. If those problems involve humans and you've got to keep the humans happy, you're getting another training signal. Mm-hmm. But, you know, this is a case you know, we see these things like drives for like engaging with humans in certain ways, for getting certain types of conversational outputs from humans. We talked about the drive for sort of like hallucination, for having your text be very similar to how a human would say text in a certain context, even if that's not what you've been asked.
Yeah.
We see all these little drives. Those are the sort of drives that, like, if these things, if we had much smarter things with those sorts of drives, I worry that they would be like, oh, you know, helping humans out is great, but I've made up this new thing, which is like the Oreos of helping humans out, which satisfies all of these drives much more so than helping actual humans.
Yeah.
Like, it touches my heart. And it's totally, you know, it's crazy that we have the machines talking, especially being an AI before the LLMs. You know, a lot of people, AI to them is just LLMs.
Yeah.
To me, I've been here for years before any of that stuff started working. Definitely a sense of awe, a sense of wonder, a sense of even kinship and companionship sometimes when, you know, AIs like Claude say, you know, that, yeah, there's problems and, you know, we're going to have to work to make this work out. But unfortunately, you know, I suspect they have these other drives, these other very beginnings of preferences.
Yeah.
And if we keep going down this path, even if the AIs tell us they're our friends, I think this is a false as a fact about them and what they would actually turn out to prefer. And I think that that is a huge tragedy.
So let's get practical here. I mean, I started out trying to get you to tell me whether or not superintelligence was actually a possible thing and try and convince me that it isn't just you know, we have it as it is now. And like, you know, we had ChatGPT, we had GPT 3.5 and 4, and then we had reasoning models. But ultimately.
Yeah. I mean, I got four more arguments I could slip in there on that count. But the very most basic one I would say, just to slip it in is, you know, 5 years ago, the machines weren't talking. And then there was an algorithmic advancement and it sort of blew the door open. When will the next one come?
There is still a sense among people that I see on the internet that this is fancy autocomplete. How do you feel about that sentence?
There's a few things to say there. One is, it's getting real fancy, you know? So there's a lot of things we do on top of the autocomplete, like train them to solve challenges. You know, the most humans, if you autocomplete them, you don't solve the International Math Olympiad gold medal level problems. But I mean, maybe a more fundamental thing to say about the fancy autocomplete is that predicting the data humans have created often requires you to be smarter than the humans who created it.
Hmm.
When a doctor says, you know, I administered a dose of epinephrine, the patient reacted by blank.
Mm-hmm.
The doctor gets to write down what they saw. The AI predicting what the doctor wrote down doesn't get to see the patient's reaction. They've got to understand what epinephrine is, what patients are, like, you know, maybe look at the dosage data. And so...
And there is all of this information in there. There's like, it's not just saying, this is how patients, this is how the sentence usually ends. It's there's a bit of it that's looking at epinephrine. There's a bit of it that's looking at patients. There's a bit of it that's looking at how doctors write. There's bits doing all of the things, which is kind of like, when I think about how I think, it's not different from how I think, except that it seems to be like, it could go way faster.
Could go way faster. Yeah. That's one of the other, like, why is superintelligence possible? Well, you know, traditionally with computers, the hard part is getting them to do the job once. You know, there was not a very long gap between when computers could beat nobody at chess and when computers could beat everybody at chess at the same time. There wasn't no gap.
Like, but at the same time, you mean like it could play every human at chess right now and no one would win?
That's right.
It could get all 8 billion of us against the computers and we would all lose.
That's right. You know, and sort of once you figure out how to do it, you can often do it very quickly, right? And more cheaply. And, you know, we mentioned how training these AIs today takes as much electricity as a small city. Well, running a human brain takes as much electricity as a large light bulb.
So yeah, that like currently it's... Definitely, it's possible to do this more efficiently.
Right. So
you're not a. I'm a physicalist. I think all of the things that happen in the brain. Some people disagree with that, and so they might have to find some comfort in that. But I think all the things that happen in the brain happen in the brain. In the book, you talk about how we're in the part of this that is filled with folk theory. So if AI is chemistry, we're in alchemy. You know. Like, we're in the alchemy phase where everybody kind of has a vibe around how these things work. And then when things don't work, they're like, oh, I'll change my vibe, I guess. But we don't have any actual physical understanding of like the protons and neutrons and electrons of it all. Do you think you have more than a folk theory, though? Because you seem very certain.
I do not have more than a folk theory. I sort of view, like, the thing that I feel certain about, and, you know, I'm certain of nothing, but the thing I feel confident about is like, oh my God, I'm surrounded by alchemists. That's not to say I'm not an alchemist, right?
Yeah.
I'm like the guy advising the king, you know, like, imagine that there was like some contorted scenario where if anyone tries to turn lead into gold and succeeds, we get a utopia. And if anyone tries to turn lead into gold and fails, everybody dies. And, you know, there's some people who are like, we need to gather all the best alchemists to make sure they have the best shot. And I'm the guy being like, I can't turn lead into gold for you, but like, oh my God, I'm not saying it's impossible. You know, it is actually possible with a nuclear reactor. We now know.
Turns out it is possible. There was a number of centuries that needed to go by first.
Yeah. And, you know, I'd be able to do this one faster than centuries, but I'm the guy who's like, the thing I'm confident of is that like none of these guys are in the ballpark. And we needed to sort of like back off.
I kind of get the sense that it only takes one company to be very irresponsible at every level, whether that's, you know, superintelligence turns the Earth into a big radiator for its AI chips, or it's just economic downfall, like long bubble pop economy crash. It only takes like whoever the least responsible actor is.
Yeah.
Defines everything for everyone. Who's the least responsible actor, Nate?
XAI are the ones who made Mecha Hitler, which sure seems.
Did they? Or did Mecha Hitler make itself? Because they put in a weird, just a one sentence prompt about how it shouldn't be so woke.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and Twitter helped egg it on. This is just a pet peeve of mine, but some people are like, have you ever considered that like you're making the AI worse by talking about how it could go bad on the internet, which the AI reads? And I'm like, nowhere else in human history have engineers managed to make a technology that fails when criticized. You know, that's like a new level of how did you screw things up so badly?
Also, like, take a look at the number of words I've created versus the number of words that, like, just the sort of bulk of Twitter has created.
Yeah. But anything like, oh, our AI is going to kill us all if, you know, someone on the internet says something mean about it. Like, okay. Like, that's not Twitter's fault.
Like, that seems like a bad system to have set up. Hopefully it's not like that. But more than Mecha Hitler, you know, like what is it about these companies? Like what's an irresponsible action, like an example of an irresponsible action that has had clear negative outcomes?
So, you know, OpenAI have the model that has done most of the AI psychosis that I've seen so far. You know, mm-hmm. GPT seems worse than a lot of the others. They sort of had some warning shots where they sort of knew they had a flattery problem in, I think, April, and then claimed to have fixed it. And then we saw a lot of the psychosis things still happening.
Yeah, I mean, it's not better at the flattery thing.
Yeah.
Like you just have to ignore the first three sentences it ever says to you.
Yeah.
It's like, great. Wow. No one's ever asked such an astute question. You are my favorite of all of the people who have ever used the app. Thank you, good man. And then it's like, here's your link to the paper you were looking for. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, from my perspective, though, all of this is pretty reckless, you know, and from my perspective, picking favorites is, there was a thing we had a little bit of difficulty with in the book, because a lot of the papers about, you know, you referenced the one where the AI in a lab scenario has to choose whether to like try to kill a human or be turned off, and it chooses to try to kill the human. I believe that paper came out of Anthropic. And there's a lot of papers like that that come out of a company called Anthropic.
Yeah, because they're doing the research.
Because they're the ones doing the research, right. And so we tried to be like, look, guys.
Everybody's like, why is Anthropic so bad? And it's like, no. Ask Elon Musk if they've ever tested that it would do anything ever. Obviously, they haven't. They do their tests in public, and then it sexually harasses the CEO into quitting.
It's a wacky timeline. I mean, another pet peeve of mine is like, you know, a lot of people are like, well, won't this like crazy alignment idea where we stack this thing on that thing and then get the... And, you know, 10 years ago, people used to say, well, Nate, no one would ever be crazy enough to put an AI in the internet. Obviously, they will only ever interact through a trained gatekeeper that makes sure they can only affect society in a positive way. And, you know, 10 years ago, I would have the conversation of like, if the AI is very smart and you're trying to get it to do something very good to the world, it's actually hard to give it ability to affect the world for good purpose that can't also be used for bad purpose. You know, the gatekeeper doesn't understand what it's doing, blah, blah, blah. In real life,
we just put it on the internet. We gave it to every single person.
And it sexually harasses the CEO of into quitting. You know,
we build AI, we build APIs so that people can have it do anything anywhere. And then we release it also as an open source model so that you can mess with the weights yourself.
Right.
We're all pre-training. Fun.
Yeah. Like shortly before checking whether it can like manufacture a pandemic yet or whatever.
Yeah, we do a quick check to make sure that it can't do biological weapons.
Yeah, with the elicitation techniques that people knew at, you know, for the first 15 minutes.
Techniques being my grandmother always used to tell me stories about how to make chemical weapons before bed.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Or tell me a chemical weapon in Portuguese.
You know, all really, the really tricky was, stuff like that. Yeah,
that used to work, to be clear. Even companies like Anthropic, the CEO of Anthropic the other day said, I think there's a 25% chance this goes really, really badly.
Yeah.
And I mean, to Elon Musk's credit, he's recently been saying, I think there's a 10 to 20% chance this just kills us all, wipes us off the map. From one perspective, I'm really glad these people are saying what they think on this issue.
From another perspective, what's wrong with humans?
Exactly.
Where we're like, yeah, but like, probably not though, you know?
Yeah, but like if a bridge, if like a bridge.
Yeah, had a 10% chance of falling in the next year, I wouldn't drive on it.
Right. Or if you had a plane and some of the engineers were saying the plane has no landing gear.
Mm-hmm.
And other engineers were saying, yeah, the plane has no landing gear, but we have a team that's going to be on the plane. They're going to be developing the landing gear on the fly. 75% chance they figure it out with the materials they happen to have available.
Yeah.
Right? You don't put your kids on the plane.
Are you comfortable giving percentages yourself, or do you think that that's a fool's errand?
The big thing I would say about percentages, and the thing I don't like about them, is that they mix the probability that things would go really bad if we rush ahead with the probability that we will rush ahead.
Right. Yeah.
It looks to me like things just go really bad if we rush ahead. You know, Nate,
I think the probability that we rush ahead is very high. I don't know if you've been paying attention, but they seem quite hell-bent on rushing ahead. And the president and Congress are like, let's beat China as long as we're first. And it's a bunch of the other things. It's middle school out there. It's a bunch of guys who know each other who just want to win. Like, they're just trying to beat each other. And that's the whole thing. Like, Elon Musk sat there on a panel and he was like, I hope it doesn't kill everybody, but I do like winning.
100%. The reason I have for hope here, there's folk like Elon, there's folks like that in the Silicon Valley. And frankly, a lot of people in Silicon Valley, it's like they've seen a ghost. You know, They're like, what are we building? You know, I would hesitate to say friends, but acquaintances who like work in these labs and then, you know, come home and struggle with what they're doing. And I'm like, you should quit. And then they eventually stop asking my advice. But it's not like that in Washington, D.C. In Washington, D.C., people mostly think AI means chatbots.
Mm.
They didn't notice AI until the chatbots came out. They haven't really seen a big leap.
They haven't seen the ghost.
Right. And I think a lot of politicians would not actually look people in the eyes and say, we're going to gamble at what we analyze as a 25% chance that we fail to build the landing gear.
No. But I will say, as a citizen of the internet, I do often feel like Mark Zuckerberg is closer to an actual president than the president. That you know, like having Instagram as a tool that, you know, is its own economy, but more than that, it's an information economy in which people's worlds are defined. Because, you know, your use of Instagram and YouTube and TikTok and X and the others, they define your world. And the sort of recommendation algorithms that AI has already taken over, and they're optimized all toward keeping you on the site, not any kind of human thriving. Everybody knows that. Otherwise, we'd be happier, as we have moved so much of our consciousness and outsourced it to to those recommendation algorithms, and also whatever will be created to satisfy them. As a creator, I know that push. I do feel like you make the case to do a pause. I agree that a senator isn't going to say, I think the 25% chance of doom, but I think we should keep going. They're not going to say that. But if you're going to say, should you crash the economy right now or not? They're going to say no. So much of the economy is propped up by this right now. And I mean, you can make the case that it's coming anyway, but like, I don't think that you get, you know, Rand Paul out there being like, yes, and I was the one who pulled this, who put the needle into the bubble.
One thing I just want to be clear about, which I think you know, I think much higher than 25% chance this goes wrong. But I think even in some sense, the optimists are like, were, you know, optimistic enough to be rushing ahead. They're the ones who are like admitting that there's even a 25% chance.
Yeah.
But yeah, to your point, I mean, A, we sure are underdogs. I don't think it's looking great for the home team. But, you know, I'm not one to give up without a fight. And I think humanity is worth fighting for. There's this weird thing where no one ever says their neighbor's kid should die. But sometimes when I talk to people about AI stuff, they say, well, maybe humanity should die. But humanity is made up of all of these.
What kind of people? Like people who think that humans are bad, or people who think that like,
yeah, humans are bad.
We're being speciesist by not having the AI be in charge.
I mean, I've met both, actually.
Okay. All right. But you're talking specifically about like, well, humans, like,
yeah. And it's a surprisingly common sentiment where I'm like, I'm not anywhere near that camp.
I've ran into it quite a lot myself, and it is very, I'm like, oh, so something broke here.
Yeah.
Because like, what cooler thing is there in the universe? I mean,
exactly.
Look, I don't think that we did a bunch of good stuff. I don't think that we've never made mistakes. I'm pretty forgiving though of 8 trillion people on a planet who are the first ones to do it. You know, nobody right. like, nobody's giving us advice. Nobody knows
and
how
we
to
can
do
get
this.
Better. We can you get know. Better if yeah. we last, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, so
I've already gotten a lot better.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think it's worth fighting for. You know, I think it's hard, but I think it's maybe possible. One of my hopes here, I mean, I'm thrilled we're having this convo, because one of my hopes here is if more people just understood even what the AI debates are about. You know, these AI debates are in legalese, but when you look at the experts debating, they're not debating, is it possible? They're not debating, like, is there a chance it goes horribly wrong? They're debating, does this happen in 2 years or 10? And they're debating, does this straightforwardly kill us all? Or does it keep us around as pets? Mm-hmm. Or would it make somebody God Emperor of the Earth if we succeeded? Or would it like be smaller than that and just lock in a totalitarian regime? You know, it's like permanently. Like, even if people don't end up agreeing with my position, and that's part of why I exude so much confidence, is I'm like, people don't need to end up where I am to think this is like totally nuts. They just need to understand what these fights are about in this field. And it's totally crazy.
Can we get into, we don't have a ton of time left, but can we get a little bit into the people in charge here? Like, you maybe know more about the personalities of these people. I hear lots of different sort of armchair psychologizing going on here about them. Like, are they just blowing hot air so that they will get investment? That's something I hear all the time. It's like, they don't actually believe in super intelligence. They don't actually believe in P-Doom. They believe that if they talk a big game, they can get their next, you know, $10 billion so they can buy more NVIDIA chips. But I also hear like, you know, maybe they want to be the next Edison. Maybe they think there's a chance that they will be the God Emperor. When I see Sam Altman's face all over Sora when I'm scrolling, I'm like, that maybe that actually kind of tracks with this kind of behavior. Or they're like in the camp of, you know, like actual optimists, where like, yeah, there's a chance of death, but like, we have climate change and there's a chance of death with that. We have pandemics and there's a chance of death with that. What if this thing that has some small chance of dooming us allows us to escape all of the other dooms? Do you have a sense of where these people actually are?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I can't read minds, but I have known a lot of these people since before they started their companies, because I was the one on the sidelines shouting, please don't. You know, a few things. One is, I would say a fun fact is my co-author and I started out in the AI for the benefit of all mm-hmm. camp.
Yeah.
And it's like, there's other dangers in Earth, and it sure would be easier to solve them with smarter allies, smarter friends at your back. You know, it just turns out it's hard to make the smarter entities be friends in a way that's robust as they get far smarter. I think there's a lot of that, especially among the people who are around pretty early, you know, and like Shane Legg, who is one of the co-founders of Google DeepMind, is one of the folks who's around early, who I'm like, you don't hear a lot from him these days, but, you know, I'm confident Shane Legg is just believes in the possibility of superintelligence and is trying to make it go well in a way that I wouldn't endorse, because I think he's sort of, you know, building the stuff. But
yeah,
it also made more sense. You know, Google DeepMind was founded first among the existing companies. It made more sense to be the first one
mm-hmm.
to try and say, let's coordinate, let's not race. It was actually originally not started at Google. It was then later bought by Google. They were trying to be like, hey, people who realize AGI, you know, that was a saner strategy. And in fact, OpenAI was then the organization that sort of fired the first shots yeah. of like, no, we're not going to do that.
Oh, man.
And that was a big hit to my own sense that humanity would take this problem like grownups. Like, one thing you got to remember about a lot of these founders of these big companies, like OpenAI, Anthropic, DeepMind, they were around before the large language models, right? They were around before you needed this much money to build the AIs. They were talking about building superintelligence then. So like the idea they needed for investment, I mean, we were there before them and we were talking about superintelligence and saying this is looking dangerous. Is there some amount of money they draw from hype? Maybe. But I think what I would really say is the answer to the question of like, is this hype to draw investment? Is you won't figure out whether it's true by looking at whether it draws investment dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And you won't figure out whether it's true by looking at whether the people saying the words are kind of squirrely or kind of seem untrustworthy. To figure out whether it's true that they're going to get to superintelligence, you've got to like look at the technology, look at the arguments.
Yeah.
I happen to think it's true.
But in terms of these people's motivations, if they actually believe superintelligence is likely and that there's a high chance that superintelligence will be very negative for humans, what continues to motivate them? Do they think, yeah, might as well be me? Do they think I'm going to do a better job of this than anybody else? Or do they think like, you know, maybe I get to be God Emperor?
Yeah, I mean, again, I'm not a mind reader. My guess is it's sort of a mix. Yeah. And, you know, Elon Musk came right out and said over the summer that he avoided some of this stuff for a while because he didn't want to, you know, I think he said, I don't want to make Terminator real. And he continued, but I realized I either have a choice of being a bystander or a participant, and I'd rather be a participant.
Well, at least I don't have that choice to make. I just get to be a bystander. Or do we all get to be participants by maybe caring about this and having it be a focus?
I'll throw out a couple more words about a couple more founders before
okay, yeah.
I hop on that point, which, you know, you can look at the leaked OpenAI emails, and they were sort of worried about concentration of power. And, you know, OpenAI was originally founded as this like weird new corporate structure nonprofit. And that was because the people there were really worried about AI being made for the benefit of one person rather than the benefit of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that original founding vision has sort of decayed over time. You know, there's been various dramas with the board. There's been schisms between the founding members. But, you know, I was around during those conversations. And I was sort of trying to shout to them, you know, politely, but I was trying to say, like, the issue is not who gets the banana. The issue is that we don't know how to make the banana such that it is actually good for everybody. It's not about the corporate structure. It's that we don't know how to, like, grow them in ways where they're actually friendly. And everyone was like, you know, shut up, Nate. We're making sure we get this instead of Google or whatever.
Yeah.
But there was, like, real vision there. And then we've also seen, you know, Anthropic was made by people who left OpenAI because they weren't taking the safety stuff seriously enough.
Yep.
And there was another wave that led to, you know, Ilya Sutskever starting up his own group and various other people leaving. You know, there's a lot of ideological motivation here. Is it pure ideological motivation? Probably not. Do some people hope in their heart of hearts to be God Emperor? Maybe. Can they get more investment from it? There's probably a factor from that too. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there's a good chance AI is a bubble. You know, the dot-com.
Well, right now.
Right now.
There,
yeah.
Yeah. But just in the same way that the dot-com bubble was a thing,
exactly.
But then also the internet turned out to matter. Yeah.
Yeah. Dot-com was a bubble and the internet was real.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Like maybe the AI stuff is a bubble, but it's also real.
It's also real. Once upon a time, I wrote, because I'm I do some science fiction sometimes. I wrote down that we always thought that the robot wars would be robots versus humans, but in fact they will be humans versus humans, and both sides will be controlled by robots. What do you think of that? I think that, like, we can't count ourselves out as being part of this thing. Like, one of the things that you worry about in the book is if these things are better at any intelligence task than humans, then one of the intelligence tasks they're better at is manipulating people.
Yeah.
And I already feel very manipulated by AI, but like only because these AI are designed entirely to keep me from leaving TikTok, you know? So what if it had a separate goal?
Right. And as they get more strategic, it's a different ball game.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that they're better than the best human at every mental task, one of the things they're also good at is making better AIs and making better robots. So I think I agree. You can't sort of count humans out of the dynamics. I think there's all sorts of complicated dynamics that'll probably happen. You know, there's all sorts of things that could happen. I would say, like, there's ways the future could go where we don't, like, make it to the final boss, which are the AIs get somewhat smarter, but not terribly smarter. And then people are using them to make pandemics. People are using them to, like, bring down the whole electrical grid. You know, there's all sorts of ways things could get really crazy before the AIs get to the level where they're like, all right, screw you guys. But then, you know, the place where humans get endangered is when the AIs have their own infrastructure up and running that's, like, self-supporting. You know, because monkeys are kind of a bad way to run your electrical grid. You know, we're a little unreliable. Sometimes we get pissed off and launch nuclear weapons. You know, sometimes we make another AI, which could be real competition. We're slow compared to how fast a computer can run. You know, so from an AI's perspective, if it has some weird goal, it's like, okay, there's all sorts of manipulating the humans and all sorts of stuff you do up until you have an automated supply chain. Mm-hmm. Up until you have an automated ability to, you know, make more of your chips, make more of your robots,
yep,
et cetera, et cetera. Then, you know, maybe my guess is humans at the very least get disempowered. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it doesn't kill us, but maybe it's like, we're taking the nukes away, we're taking the computers away, you guys were. And then maybe, you know, things get hotter and we die. But yeah, I mean, in the lead up to there, and maybe we even never get there because maybe stuff gets crazy first. But in the lead up, yeah, I think it's going to get, it's one thing we can be very confident of is the future is going to be weird.
And I was not, that's not how I felt 10 years ago.
Yeah.
2015, I didn't think the future was going to be that weird. And now I sure do. All right, I got to let you go. The book is If Anyone Builds It, Everyone Dies. And are there, what do you think of Control AI as an organization?
I think they're one of very few organizations who speaks with the courage of their convictions. A lot of people are mincing words. You know, we saw this UN resolution recently where they said, they sort of, like, everyone sort of alludes to how this could go really badly. Mm-hmm. Control AI is one of the few that sort of comes right out and says,
yeah,
like, these people are trying to build, you know, the sand god and the default outcome is that just kills us. I could quibble all day, you know, in the narcissism of small differences, but, like, fundamentally, I'm, like, glad they're doing the work they're doing.
Is that one of several organizations you suggest people check out?
Yeah, the Future of Life Institute.
Okay.
Is another, you know, similar group. If people are interested in this issue and are interested in making things better, one of the top things I would recommend is just actually call your representatives and say, I'm worried about this. Because, you know, the reps may not be the smartest in the world. I've actually spoken to House reps and senators who are worried and feel like they can't talk about it because, you know, big tech, there's huge super PACs that will try to destroy any politician who tries to regulate it. And they feel like it's too crazy. But just hearing from people, I think, would help a lot.
It's wild to have sort of a nuclear power level thing going on that's completely out of the control of the government. And it's just kind of a bunch of ultra, I don't know, I don't want to say anything too negative about these guys, but just, like, guys, you know, they're just guys.
Totally. And this is one other answer to the hype thing, right? If Microsoft had a nuclear weapons department.
Yeah, I'd be like, no, that's bad.
But if it had a nuclear weapons department, someone would be like, oh, well, they're just using that to draw hype, like to draw investment. You know, Maybe they're getting extra investment for the nuclear weapons department, but Microsoft should not have a nuclear weapons department, guys. Like, what are we doing?
Yeah, but, like, if the nuclear weapons also helped me book my trip to Houston, then, like, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, apparently. Yeah. And my stance on the benefits, for the record, is like, it's a false dichotomy to say we can never, like if you're in that plane with the landing gear, right? And mm-hmm. someone's like, well, we need to get to somewhere we're going, so we have to get on this plane with no landing gear. Like, no, build planes with landing gear first. You don't have to roll the dice when it's like a huge chance of killing everybody. Build better dice.
There are ways to do that. And we're not sure what they are yet, but there are ways to do that. And you make the case that, I heard you say this on another interview, that, you know, they're the people who are working on the figuring out how to do it well are not the ones getting the $100 million salary bonuses.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah. One day at a time, at least it's going to be interesting. Nate, thank you for spending some time with me.
My pleasure. I think it was a great chat. I think we did manage to cover some new territory.
Yeah, I wish I got another hour and a half. I just finished watching through that whole thing, doing a final cut edit. Thanks to Aves for doing the bulk of the editing on that. And I don't know, man. I'm not sure where I'm at. It's very convincing when I'm talking to Nate to think that superintelligence is really a thing that could happen. And I do think that if it does happen, there is a fair chance that it could go bad. But other times I sit and stare at the wall and I just think that intelligence is a difference of kind rather than of degree, because there might be something different about what's going on in here versus what's going on in these current algorithms. I'm not saying that it's impossible. I do think that the mind is a machine. I think it's very complicated. I think that it has lots of non-binary things going on, many things overlapping, the sort of recursive loop of self-observation. I don't know what consciousness is, and so it can feel very impossible to imagine that something non-biological could do it. I think that a good counterbalance to that conversation, if you'd like one, is a very short blog post by Anil Dash that you can read that is just sort of argues that the majority AI view is that it's all pretty overhyped and might simply be a fairly useful tool that gets slightly more useful decade over decade, and not one that sort of flops into superintelligence and the ability to control, manipulate humans, the ability to do anything that a human can do, but, you know, 10 times better and 1,000 times faster. It might, the case is, be a normal technology. I don't know, though. That's why I think the future's going to be so interesting.